Before we jump into today's show, I've got a few important things to share with you. First, I want to tell you about my friends over at DesignQ. DesignQ is a subscription-based graphic design service that gives you access to unlimited graphic design support for one simple monthly price. With that, you also get unlimited design revisions at no additional cost. And just like your Netflix subscription, you can pause or cancel at any time. But why would you want to? The DesignQ team is fantastic and they do great work. I know this to be true because the DesignQ team does all of my personal graphic design work and they're great to work with. Check out DesignQ for all your ongoing graphic design needs. That's designq.co. Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where we bring you tips and insights to help you raise more money for your organization and lead more effectively. I'm your host, Andrew Olson.
Hey, this is Andrew Olson. I'm excited to be here today with my good friend and colleague, Kat Landa. Kat, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Hey, so we are going to talk today about the most common and dangerous mistakes that leaders make in hiring in the nonprofit sector. And for context, Kat is the Senior Vice President of Talent Solutions at Dickerson Baker, a longtime friend and colleague of mine. And I had the opportunity to hear her speak at this year's Christian Leadership Alliance conference, where she spoke to a packed room of hiring managers and chief human resource officers and probably a number of other folks in different roles. But it was a really insightful conversation on those hiring mistakes. So that's what we want to talk about today. Kat, I guess start with, tell us a little bit first about what Talent Solutions is and what you and your team do.
Yeah, absolutely. So Talent Solutions was born from our initial efforts at Dickerson Baker in executive search, right? So that's probably our flagship product, I would still say, in terms of services that we offer clients to place senior executives at your nonprofit. So that we specialize in development specifically and C-level. So your next chief development officer, major gift officer, your CFO, or your new ED, CEO. Those are kind of the places that we live. We essentially, I don't think we ever set out to necessarily provide that, but in working in campaign work, fundraising in general, it just continued to come up as a need for clients. So eventually we were like, we need a resource to make that happen. So years and years ago, started adding some of that talent to the team today, you know, that have blossomed into a full executive search practice, and Talent Solutions is blossoming into yet another area, which is sort of the full cycle of employee engagement, right? So beyond getting them to you, right? Then what happens? Those pieces of retention, how do you train and grow and coach people along the way? All of the things that kind of make up that full employee cycle in their experience. So we are now kind of coaching and showing into all of those areas.
Awesome. So let's start in on this. Talk to us a little bit, like, what are some of the big mistakes that you see hiring managers make, and what should they be doing instead?
I think one of the biggest mistakes we see is people rushing. So it's such a pressure and a feeling of urgency, particularly, I think, in almost any role, particularly in roles that are directly related to revenue, that we have to get it done. We got to get it done quickly. We need a butt in a seat, right? And I understand that. I understand the feeling that comes with that, the pressure that comes with that. However, that is where some of the biggest mistakes happen and the most costly mistakes happen. We're rushing into it. We're going to just take, you know, whatever comes our way, you know, warm body and just put them in there. And then we end up with all kinds of issues because we didn't do a great job. A lot of people we really want to work with and vetting them really appropriately. And now we're spending an extra 6 months fighting someone and the seat's empty longer and we're in a bigger financial hole than we were in the first place. So rushing is definitely one of the instincts we really have to push again and help our clients push again. Now that doesn't mean our own process is just long and arduous, but it does take some time to really reflect and understand where you're at as an organization, and then to all agree to what that is, right? And in some respects, and eventually find the person that's going to be best matched to that to really help you get where you're trying to go. So rushing, huge mistake.
So in reality, like what should, for a senior level fundraiser, for a major gift officer, right? Something like that, or anything in the C-suite, like just to help people level set, what should that timeline look
like? Yeah. And a typical search from Suchinet's assessment phase and conversations and analysis all the way to the close, we're looking at typically 4 to 6 months. I would say 4 on the fast side. It just so happened you found that candidate early on and it'll work out pretty quickly and easily. 6 in total when it's taken a little bit longer and we really have to go out there and dig a little bit. Part of the level set on that is that even 18 months ago, you could post a position with no third-party help, pretty good idea of what the job is, receive a group of applicants that are actually pretty darn good, go through your own process, hopefully fairly thoroughly, and find your candidate. That is not the same today. And that's one of the biggest differences that I've seen in the industry is that you can post all you like, but you are very, very unlikely to get really solidly qualified applicants. It's a surprise to us when it's that quick and easy just off of the applicant pool.
Yeah, you know, that's really insightful and it rings true. So I was doing a search for our team earlier this year. Actually, your team helped us with that search. We had something like 215 people apply and 4% of them were qualified, right? So it's like, hey, you get really excited. You're like, wow, so many people are interested. And then you go through and you're like, they have none of the things that I asked about, right? So that actually tracks. It makes a lot of sense. I want to stay on this whole issue of rushing for a minute. Can you give us some examples of some of the things that people miss when they rush?
Yeah. I think the number one thing that people miss when they rush is that they haven't really defined the goal of this new role or this replacement role. And what I mean by that is you're thinking, oh, well, we had a major gift officer and we're hiring one. Are you though? Because let's talk about where the program is at, right? You have to almost take this half a step back and say, do we need the exact same thing today? So especially with replacement roles, you know, new roles are happening because there's some sort of discussion testing where the vision is headed, right? In a replacement role, I mean, you know, an executive director, let's say. You're like, yeah, we need to know the executive directors. The board committee pulls together and says, let's do this. However, what kind do you need? Do you need someone who's just cut from the same cloth as who was leading prior? Do you need someone who can pick it up from there and take it in a new direction, right? So that, just defining what it is that you need for this point in time for the organization, that's where I see a lot of missteps. Another one is in, you know, not thoroughly vetting, right? So what could that mean? Again, now that you've identified, like, this is what we really need, the set of skills and experience that we need, if you get so excited about someone that comes in and kind of seems like they're walking the talk, you know, the whole thing, and you're enamored, and you kind of get, you know, cut the corners in terms of, like, you know, talking to their references or asking them some tough questions or some situational questions about what they had actually accomplished in their past. And you just really like them and they're personable and that's great. But have they done the work before? Did they successfully accomplish the things that you need them to accomplish in this next role? You have to stick through that vetting process and be really, really mindful of making sure you're actually asking if they've done the work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, cool. What's the next big mistake you see?
Yeah, the next big mistake is around reference checking. And I just, I've had a number of conversations even since that. It came up at that CLA presentation. And I was really surprised to find out that there was this big gap in terms of reference checking. So I think I can help a lot of people very quickly by just commenting on that. So number one, there were a number of organizations that are not checking references. So the step number one, you need to check professional references. Step two is, when I say professional, you don't ask the candidate, hey, give me 3 references to call people that you know in your life. No, 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 no. We're going to ask really specifically, I would like to talk to a previous employer, doesn't have to be the current one, but someone you reported to. I want to talk to someone who reported to you, if you've ever been in a position where you're leading other team members. And then I want to talk to a third colleague or volunteer or board member or something in your space so that I can get a real good 360 degree view of your work and what you've done previously. So very prescriptive. I don't think a lot of people are doing that. Then,
yeah, so
go ahead.
Let's pause there for a second. I was really surprised in the room at that conference how many people made some sort of reference to either we're not allowed to, or there's a rule that says we can't, or something like that. Like, where does that come
from? Yeah, that's a tough one. So there are a lot of organizations who have moved towards a policy that they do not provide references, right? So you might work in an organization where they told you can't give them out. So this gets a little tough to get around. And the reason why people put that in place is liability, right? It's just unfortunate. Reality of our society at the moment is that there is a lot of potential risk for liability involved with giving references. So I am starting to see that more and more. Typically, however, for the moment, most people have worked in enough organizations that shouldn't be a dead end for them all the way around. They pick a different one. That's fine. You come back and say, my best one that I really love to give you, they can't give it out, that kind of thing. But they should be able to pull something somewhere.
Okay. So, let's say that you've got the, you've got this, hey, they've given me three or five or however many people to talk to. Then what else are you seeing? And because there were some great ideas and challenges that you talked about in that part of the session. So talk to us more about that.
So when you actually conduct it, I've also heard that a number of people are emailing references. Like, hey, here's a question. Get this back to me when you can. Okay, not great, right? So there's so much to be gained from a live conversation. And it doesn't have to take a long time. I just checked references today for a position that's being hired. They're 30-minute calls. I asked 18 questions in 30 minutes. And I got really deep insight into strengths and weaknesses. And one of my favorite questions to ask is, what advice would you give to the future manager of this person? That's such an insightful thing to hear, especially live. There's a lot of, you can tell a lot, because I also got asked, how do you know that they're not just blowing smoke and saying all these nice things to the person? When you have a lot of conversation, you can really tell whether there's a little nuance or maybe a little concern or maybe a little excitement even on the upside, right? And you're able to get a little more insight into what it would be like to have that person on the team. And that doesn't mean if you see any kind of flag of any negative thing, you're just like, that's it, it's over. Sometimes it's really helpful to know, okay, that person, like, they really have up to goal. So when I work with them, I'm going to want to set really clear, number goals for them that they obviously really thrive and they really meet that expectation. That's a great piece of information for the organization and for the hiring manager to know about that person.
Yeah. So I want to pause you because you said you did 18 questions in 30 minutes. I've probably been a reference for 15 to 20 people in the last handful of years. And I don't think I've ever been asked more than 5 questions. Like, what's normal and what's optimal?
Well, I'm starting to understand that maybe what I've always learned and then number of places is not as normal as I thought it was. But I think optimally, here's the thing about these questions. Some of those questions are very brief, right? Would you hire this person or work with them again? Yes. Okay. That's one question. But when you ask follow-up questions or slightly more detailed questions about the nuances of the role that they're going to play, you're just going to get a lot better information. Right. So for instance, we don't need to go crazy with it. Let's say there's 3 main components to the role, a leadership component, a fundraising component, and a team management component, right? Then ask 3 to 5 questions in those 3 areas. You're at 15. And this isn't like I'm not asking about what did they do when they were 15 after school and da da da. Basic questions in these areas. What's their leadership style? How did you experience this? Did they invest in you? Those are all pretty quick and related questions that give me more layers of feedback about that person by the time that I'm done. Yeah.
So random sidebar question on this. With the increase in adoption of platforms like LinkedIn, how much stock do you put in, say, references that might be listed on LinkedIn versus actually like a live engagement?
That's a great question. I mean, I have never checked someone's references on LinkedIn.
Okay.
Say good that. To know. That doesn't mean they couldn't be valuable. Like thinking about, I feel like what, you know, when you first, when it was first coming out, you know, however many years ago, and you're prompted to like ask a few people to write you a reference. And some people, I think, who have, you know, fully online presence and businesses, it's probably bread and butter to getting, you know, if you're going to set up a coaching relationship, or, you know, you have all your people that they're the best coach ever. I have never used them for placing rules like what we're talking about here today, but there's no reason that you couldn't. And certainly if you've had something negative on there, you'd want to address that.
Sure. So it's just a potential extra data point,
right? It's an extra data point. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else around references and the mistakes people make there?
I think the other thing is to keep good record, right? So, you know, I think a lot of people, even if they have that phone call, like, that was a great phone call, click, and then they're like, hey, it was good. It was a positive reference. I document the conversation. Like, here's everything that was said in the conversation, right? And then we put that in a file, and then it goes, and, you know, there's a lot of telephones to be lost on passing that kind of information through the organization. So having good documentation is really important.
Yeah, you know, you said something else in the room during the conference when you were talking about this that I had never thought of before. You said something about, like, one of the questions you ask is, did the person prepare you for this call? I like, in all my career, I've never heard that question from someone who is recruiting. Talk more about that.
Yeah, I asked that question for a couple of reasons. One, I want to know, you know, a little more, again, insight about that candidate and how did they treat those relationships, right? So the ideal answer is something like, yeah, they called me, we went to coffee, or they booked some time with me, and they reviewed the profile. I could see exactly why they'd want to do a job like this. Here's my only concern about that. I mean, that's kind of what I want to hear. I don't want to hear, no, I don't know what the rule is that they're talking about, but they said I'd be getting the call. I mean, that's like, okay. I mean, again, no one piece of data is how you make a decision. Just like you don't use a personality test, you make a decision to eliminate a candidate. I wouldn't eliminate someone or there, but it's just another piece of data. Are they thorough? Do they know how to build that relationship? Same thing if I say, you know, if I get on the phone with them and they haven't talked to that person in years, but they're doing the reference, like, that, you know, it says something. It says something about the relationship.
Yeah, that makes total sense. All right, what other big red flags or big hiring mistakes do you see people make?
I think another big red flag is that there's a lack of clarity on the role and how they communicate that to candidates. Like, here's what's expected of you, right? And there, I've seen both a lack of clarity in the expectations in the hiring process and conversation, or B, a bait and switch when it comes to the actual role. So it goes all the way back to what I said at the beginning of, like, studying that, why is this person here? What do we need for this point in time? But it's really keeping that consistent throughout. And it comes from knowing where you started, right? What was the goal for this role? But I definitely have seen an organization get either to the end of the process or have hired the person and then sort of switch it up and go, well, you know, we actually really want that person to run these events. And that, well, that's not who I identified, and that's not what you brought them in for, right? That's
right.
Certainly going to cost you in the end, because that person's not going to be where they shine the best. You know, you're just going to kind of be grading each other a little bit along the way in the process. Another big mistake is to bring too many cooks into the kitchen. So let's talk about when you have a board or a committee involved, whether or not it's just an internal committee of folks that you want speaking into the process, or it's for, you know, executive director, CEO, CPOP, hiring committee from the board coming in. In both of those scenarios, just like anywhere else, the more people and personalities that you have, the more unwieldy that process can become. Right? So that becomes a bit of an issue. That doesn't mean that you want to exclude folks that are going to have a loud voice at some point, because this will come up anyway, right? But it means that you need to kind of get the buy-in where necessary and narrow down who's involved in the actual final decision-making. Because that can get you in a lot of trouble unnecessarily.
So, yeah, I'm actually really curious about this, because there are so many organizations that have such a sort of, you know, we're collaborative as part of our, you know, culture, right? And we jokingly say things like, yeah, and now the, you know, the guy that trims the weeds outside is making decisions on what your marketing should look like, right? And I feel like sometimes the same thing happens in an interview process. In fact, I personally, years ago, interviewed at a higher education institution and had 18 people in the interview process, right? And I felt overwhelmed, right? But so that part makes total sense. Sort of maybe a connected, or maybe it's a different issue, but I feel like there's also this thing of like, someone will say, well, I applied to this position in March, and in June they finally got back to me and said, hey, we're ready to interview you now. And then it was a 9-step process after that.
All like, that.
What do you see? Talk more about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I understand the need to be sure, the need to involve the right people in the process. But the longer the process and the more people in that, the more you're signaling to everyone in the world, that you're not on top of it, that you're not organized, that you aren't strategic, that you do make every decision by committee. And it's not strong leadership, that's weak leadership, right? And you're telling them right off the bat, that's the experience you're going to get here. So unless this person is coming in to be a change maker and to fight against that particular system to help it in a better place, you're just letting them know that that's, you know, a good reason to stay away, right?
Well, I would imagine that it filters out some of the best candidates too, right?
That absolutely, because your best strong leaders are going to see that a mile away and say, not for me. This is not a place that I want to be. I'm not able to thrive in that environment. I'm going to be bogged down and not done. So that, like I said, all bad behavior. You know, another bad behavior that I just recently found out the whole thing I'm reading about is just being cheap and not even wanting the compensation. This organization, you know, essentially had this person come to an office that's not like the home office, a separate office, an office that this person will not be traveling to for regular and consistent meetings. They'll be in a different one. Like a 3-hour drive, didn't comment or anything about getting there. And this was a real hot debate, so I understand both sides of the story, but essentially, you know, whether the person asked for it or somehow it came up that, you know, reimbursed mileage. And they took the stance that they were not going to reimburse for that, even though their existing employees that have to travel to this other out-of-the-way office do get mileage reimbursement. And they basically just say, hey, it was great to be with you. You're one of our top candidates, but we're not going to reimburse your mileage.
And we're talking about like $15 to $20 at that point. I mean, that's ridiculous, right?
I understand. You know, there's a lot of debate of paying people for their time in the process, or working on having them do actual work product and all that kind of stuff. But we are talking about, look, if you want a top candidate and you have to fly them out or you have to pay mileage to get them there, do it. You know, what is it? Cut off your nose to spite your face, right? Like, you want a strong professional leader, pay for their flight. It's going to be worth it to you in space. Or you can take a B player who will not question why they're not getting, you know, the flight out, and they can be play at your organization, right? When do you want?
So you said the phrase B players. I know that in your presentation, you mentioned this idea of like, I don't know if you said settling for a B player or how you talked about it, but talk about the differences, not just in how they show up in the work world, but, you know, sort of what the magnetism is for people in those different categories.
It affects more than you think. So the issue with sort of settling for someone who's not a lead candidate is that it brings down the whole organization, right? So sometimes, and the when it comes up the most is when we're talking about what we can afford. Right? We are in that nonprofit space. We understand the resource limitation. So first of all, a lot of nonprofits will think of themselves as not able to get top talent, right? Because of those constraints. And it's a fast-paced system. You don't go, hey, I'd really like to build a C-level organization, right? So don't, you know, take off that type of thinking. Yes, you can get excellent talent, and let's craft a strategy to do that, right? Secondly, once you have the opportunity for it, don't settle for less than that, right? Because what happens is, as you kind of bring in some of that B-level players, they don't attract A-level players, they only attract B-level players, right? So now you're impeding the whole system, the whole organization, because of that singular choice to bring in maybe the B player over the A player, right? A players always bring in players. The people that they know and the talent that they have and the partnerships and the relationships, they tend to be in the same arenas, right? Really high performance individuals hang out with really high performance individuals. So that's who they're bringing into your orbit, right? And vice versa. So it's not a singular decision when you, you know, sort of settle for something less than what you're looking for.
So the next one I want to talk about, you talked at one point about like job descriptions and making sure that they're like clear and accurate and all this kind of stuff. But then you also, you use this phrase like profile or something. And I've only like in most of the jobs I've ever applied for and all that kind of stuff, I've only ever seen a job description. What's a profile? How is it different? Yeah. Like, how do you use them?
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's sort of like, you know, I'm going to use real estate for a second as an example. And if you haven't been in that game or market for a while, it may not be that top of mind for you. But if you have, you'll recognize this right away. So it used to be similarly that you would just kind of like put your house listing and there might be one photo of the outside of your house. And, you know, it was full in a matter of months and it was all said and done and that's great. And full house looks real cute in that one picture. And that is not how it works anymore. Now you have drone video footage coming flying in over your house. You hire people to stage your house with fake, furniture and so forth. Take high level professional pictures and then a story editor writing your description of, you know, it's just like how people are on LinkedIn when they're talking about their position, right? Like, oh, I didn't know you were running, you know, UN. Well, you're not, right? But anyhow, so truly, we've become such a society so enamored with that marketing that an opportunity profile is really a marketing version of a job description. The nuts and bolts are still, here are the qualifications. Here's what you're going to be doing in the role. Here's who you report to, et cetera. But we're going to tell people so much more about what they're walking into. We're going to use imagery from the organization. You're going to see the end result of the impact that the work being done is accomplishing, right? You're going to see what it's like in the area where the office is. You're going to understand more about the leader who you'd be reporting to, like almost, you know, sometimes the whole profile on here's the type of leader you're walking into. Here's the type of, you know, and then even to the point where what the really successful supplement, even that document, is a video footage, right? Wouldn't you be more inclined to maybe even take the call or talk to someone about an organization if you saw a 1 minute video clip of the leader that you're going to be reporting to and kind of get a feel for them and their style and how they talk about the organization and the vision that they set? Right? That's where we're moving into. That's kind of what it takes. And now when we're in a market where I don't think people are realizing how big the talent cliff is. There is first of all, we're not educating enough people in our field to fill all the available roles. That's what the numbers tell us. Secondly, we have a retirement wave that is far greater than we have ever had before. Right? I'm already seeing it. I'm already seeing it in some particular roles as well. We don't have enough people being educated in, and we have a bunch of people headed out. And if you read that, I think it was Chronicle story the other day, we also have a lot of people leaving the profession, not just because of the burnout and those other things. They're leaving to become individual consultants. Well,
of course.
They're leaving CDO jobs and other things open, right? And so there's even fewer people on the market to fill the available roles. So all these tactics, all this strategy, and all this intentionality about the world and how you present it to the world is going to be just invaluable as we continue along in this particular talent market.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me. I mean, I think it makes total sense, particularly for where the world is today. It is so different than what I remember, you know, even 5 years ago, right?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Are there other big mistakes, or did we cover them?
We covered the biggies, I have to say. I think,
okay,
you know, the only other thing that I think is valuable to make a distinction about is we talked a lot about post, and then you would just, you know, get the applicants and that's not happening. Well, you have to replace that activity. So how is it going to happen, right? So I think just like, you know, in the really big misconception of things like, well, if you need more money, why don't you give Jeff Bezos a call, right? There's also this conception of like, oh, well, if we need this, you know, whatever, new fundraiser or executive director, then let's just call all our networks up and see who's available, right? Yes, it's a great step. You may very well uncover, or you may uncover someone who uncovers someone else. So definitely part of the process, but you can't rely on it alone. So there's a whole kind of segment of this work called sourcing, and that's going out into the passive employment market, which is people sitting in their jobs, seemingly fairly happy, just doing what they do, and knocking on their door or tapping them on the shoulder and saying, would you like to talk about this role? And that's a key piece of the process that very few people have built internally. Even in really large organizations on the corporate side, some of them have that sourcing functionality and some of them farm it out. But everybody knows that you kind of need it to fill roles now because it is that tight. It's that tight of a market and it's difficult to get applicants. So, you know, not filling that gap somehow with some sort of sourcing effort or arrangement is a big missed opportunity to find a really great talent.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. I mean, I actually talked to somebody today who said that their internal strategy was to post on Indeed and then to ask their HR people to put something on LinkedIn, and that's it, right? Now, they might get candidates. I don't think they get the right ones. It probably takes an extra, you know, quarter at least to get good talent when it's such a set it and forget it kind of passive approach.
Exactly. And here's the thing we didn't talk a lot about here, but we should, is I think one of the biggest things that we overlook is the cost of all of this, right? So it costs money to work with a third party to do this. It costs, you know, internal research to do things. However, the longer that position is open, especially if it's a revenue-driven position, the worse that is for the organization, right? Some of the metrics out there right now on what it is really costing in terms of internal time, hours, and loss of income is in the several hundred thousand range.
Wow. For like a single fundraiser?
A single fundraiser. Of the estimates are up to 200% of that person's annual salary is the cost of losing that person or not having that person. And I think we are really missing something there, right? Because it's like, oh, I don't know if we can afford to need another quarter, But actually the opportunity cost is much higher, much higher.
Yeah. So the opportunity cost piece is so critical. And you're right. We hear it all the time. Well, we're going to try this internally. And if we can't figure it out, we'll do something later. And to your point, like if later 6 months, I mean, just think about the critical window for fundraising for most organizations, right? So we're coming up on June. If I wait 6 months to hire, I'm into next year's revenue opportunities. I can't even act on this year, right? That's a huge issue. That makes a lot of sense. Well, Kat, thank you for being here. This was a great conversation. I love talking about these issues. I personally learned a ton in this, and I hope our listeners do. I want to leave people with a bonus, though. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. This has been all about hiring mistakes. Tell us what you think the biggest onboarding mistake is once you've hired a new person and how they should address that.
Sounds maybe like a boring answer, but it is the absolute most true answer. What onboarding? I don't know about you, but it's exceedingly rare for me to see a even thought out, put on a piece of paper on onboarding process for an employee in the nonprofit space. It's sad.
Yeah.
Really sad.
Absolutely. Well, even in the for-profit space, right? So I've been in, I think, 7 companies, 2 of them have had onboarding.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, we've both probably consulted for hundreds and hundreds of charities at this point, and I can probably count on one hand the number that have ever had some sort of onboarding process.
It's almost like spending a ton of money on acquisition and then just totally abandoning them in cultivation, right? Like why would you do that? But it is what ended up happening. And it's just because it hasn't been part of the DNA. And again, it's something that's hard to quantify. Truly, after making such a huge investment in time, hours, resources, hiring a third party to get the right person in, and then just abandoning them to themselves to figure it out, right? That, you know, it's like throwing money away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Awesome. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for being here. How do people reach you if they want to talk
to you? You can find me on DickersonBaker.com. You can email me directly. All my information is there. You can find me on LinkedIn. And I'd be happy to answer questions, consult, whatever you need.
Awesome. Thank you again. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. I have 2 favors to ask before I let you go. First, if you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and review us on whatever podcast platform you use to listen to this show. It'll help us reach more people with the tips and insights that you find most valuable. My second favor is a little bit of a favor to ask, but also a little bit of a gift to you. I write a daily Substack newsletter called the Leadership Growth Newsletter. It's free to you, and I write it to help people lead more effectively in both life and at work. I'd love for you to click the link in the show notes and subscribe to that newsletter as well. Until next time, friends, I hope you make it a great day.